Please have a seat. Good late morning. I'm Eyal Nave from Tel Aviv University, and I'm happy to be here. And I will chair the third panel on politics of resistance and mobilization. We will have three panelists: Hizki Shoham from Shalom Hartman Institute at Bar-Ilan University, Derek Katzam, University of Texas and Permian Basin, and Lori Flores, State University of New York at Stony Brook. I don't have a real professional connection to the topic of boycotts. Currently, I'm just the head of the History Department at Tel Aviv University, and my professional interest is U.S. history and Israeli history, so I'm quite fit to this particular panelist because I deal with U.S. and Israel. But I have some personal connection to boycott. In 1999, a textbook that I've written to the Israeli school system was under the threat of being boycotted by an extreme right-wing organization, namely Women in Green. And I can, you know, personalize and experience a very personal experience of being under the threat of boycott. So it will be some topic to our small talks during coffee breaks and lunch and dinner. And the second time that I'm participating in a project of a dual narrative approach, Palestinian-Israeli textbook with two narratives. My Palestinian colleague is now under the threat of being boycotted by the Normalization Committee of Palestine, which is an attempt not to normalize relationship with Israel. And these are this kind of indirect relationship that they have to boycott. Anyhow, I'm really glad that we have three panelists here. And the first panelist is Hizki Shoham. Hizki Shoham from Shalom Hartman Institute at Bar-Ilan University. He is a cultural historian of Zionism and Israel and a cultural theoretician. He is currently the research fellow in the Institute for Advanced Jewish Studies at Shalom Hartman Institute at Jerusalem. And in October 2013, he is about to begin a tenure-track position at the Interdisciplinary Program for Hermeneutics and Cultural Study at Bar-Ilan University, Israel. His Hebrew book, Mordechai is Riding a Horse, Purim Celebration, Tel Aviv, 1908-1936, and The Building of the New Nation, have recently been published by Bar-Ilan University Press. The second person in our panelists is Derek Charles Katzam, University of Texas of the Permian Basin. Derek Katzam is an associate professor of history, the University of Texas of the Permian Basin. He received his BA from the Williams College and MA from the University of North Carolina, Charlotte, and his PhD from Ohio University, where he was a student in the Contemporary History Institute. He also spent a year as a postgraduate student at Rhodes University in Grahamstown, South Africa, where he was a Rotary Fellow. He's the author of Freedom's Mainline, The Journey of Reconciliation and the Freedom of Rights, University Press of Kentucky. And Bleeding Red, the Red Sox fan, diary of the 2004 season. He's currently working on a book on bus boycotts in the United States and South Africa in the 1940s and 1950s. He wrote about African affairs for the New York-based Foreign Policy Association, also had contributed columns on both American and African politics to many newspapers and other publications. The third panelist is Lori Flores of State University of New York at Stony Brook. She is an assistant professor of history at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. She received her bachelor's degree in history from Yale University in 2005, and a PhD in history from Stanford University in 2011. At Stony Brook, she teaches course on the history of Latino in the United States and the United States-Mexico border region, and the American working class. She has received fellowships from the Huntington Library, Walter Rotter Library, Stanford Humanities Center and Ford Foundation for her research and scholarship. Lori's published work has won prizes from the Western History Association and the Pacific Coast branch of the American Historical Association. She is currently writing her first book, Fields of Division, to be published by Yale University Press, about the relationship between the U.S.-born and immigrant Latinos in 20th century California agriculture and civil rights politics. I will ask the panelists to present their paper and to adhere strictly to the 20 minutes presentation, so we'll have time to have further discussion. So please, I invite now Chizki Shoham to present his paper, Buy Only Tozeret Haaretz, Separatist Consumption in British Mandate on Palestine. Chizki, please.
Good morning. Before beginning to talk about consumer boycotts in British Mandate Palestine, I'd like to thank David, Scott, and Michael for putting this wonderful conference together. A friend emailed me last night and said, wow, that's a depressing topic. And I said, no, have fun. And also, David began yesterday by mentioning that there are speakers from four continents. I guess I'm here to represent Asia. And that's a large responsibility. Okay, so buy local campaigns cropped up after World War I almost all over the world, in all Europe, the Americas and Asia, the Middle East and Palestine included. Industrialists, merchants, labor unions, journalists, consumer organizations, and in some cases, government authorities, waged extensive campaigns imploring consumers to favor local products even if, or precisely when, those were more expensive or in lower quality. But if you ask the campaigners, many would argue that boycotts was quite a harsh word to describe these campaigns. Rather, they relied on the doctrine of economic nationalism, which was the leading fiscal doctrine of the period, but in addition involved attempts to shape national identity in the sphere of consumption by linking the mundane act of purchase to the nation's strength and associating the consumption of foreign products with national degradation. Several historians who have studied by local campaigns in interwar era have argued that their effects on the shopping habits of consumers were often negligible. This theme is coming over and over again in the presentations in this conference. However, the moral pressure they created often generated a sense of national belonging in public discourse, particularly at times of political crisis. Moreover, the campaigns expanded the political field by drawing non-political social groups and realms of activity into nationalist movements. My talk today will focus on the Jewish campaigns advocating ethno-national separatism in consumption in British Mandate Palestine of interwar era. In line with the doctrine of economic nationalism, the Zionist movement attempted to build a Jewish economy that would be as independent from non-Jewish interests as possible, as part of the consistent attempt of Zionism to promote the construction of exclusivist Jewish identity en route to an independent Jewish polity. Yet, the situation of the Yishuv, the Jewish Society of Palestine, a settler immigrant society building political institutions as a state in the making, was unique in the global scene of bi-local campaigns in this period, which I've now discovered. Maybe it wasn't that unique, but well, okay, maybe we'll talk about it later. Unlike sovereign nation states, Jews in Mandate Palestine did not control a state with the sovereign power to collect tariffs or manage a consistent fiscal policy. Unlike anti-colonial nationalist movements, their main thrust was directed against the competing national movement with which they shared the territorial unit, and not in the economic realm against the imperial power, the British. Hence, the Jewish economy that took shape was defined by two parameters, ethno-national and territorial. These two components were not fully aligned, as we shall see today. Bi-local campaigns were uncommon in the Middle East before World War I, with a few exceptions, such as the anti-European Ottoman campaigns around the constitutional movements of 1908. Actually, it was most directed against Austrian and Hungarian products. Right after the Great War, however, bi-local campaigns emerged across the region. reflecting new discourses of economic nationalism that attributed national identity to the borders drawn after the defeat and division of the Ottoman Empire. At the same time, processes of urbanization and industrialization had contributed to the expansion of middle-class consumer societies in parts of the Middle East, including Arab Palestine. Palestine's Jewish sector also witnessed the emergence of an urban middle class, particularly at the rapidly developing Tel Aviv metropolitan area. These new middle class cultures emphasized self-fulfillment and self-expression through the act of consumption, which was increasingly politicized by both nationalist movements. In Palestine, via buy local campaigns directed against the other movement, no less than against imports. A number of organizations were created during the 1920s to encourage separatist Jewish consumption. Many of them were merchants and manufacturers' associations that coordinated marketing endeavors and used nationalist patriotic arguments to promote their products in the Jewish market. Others were local civil society initiatives, including chambers of commerce, workers' councils, youth groups, and political clubs. Teachers, political leaders, and prominent cultural figures were among the initiators and activists of these campaigns, which were sometimes partially financed by manufacturers and, on rare occasions, by Zionist institutions such as the Zionist executive. Women's organizations and youth movements provided the campaigns with resources and battalions of volunteers, whereas, and that refers to Elizabeth's comment before, many of the male campaigners were paid officials. The tension between the territorial and the ethnic definitions of the economic unit, which should have been protected, was apparent in the main campaign slogan, "Buy only Tozeret Haaretz." The literal meaning of this Hebrew slogan is, "Buy only local products of this land, Palestine," or in short, "Buy local." However, it clearly meant "Buy Jewish." That is, boycott not only imports, but also non-Jewish local products, which meant, by the way, meant not only Arab products, but also products of the German Templars, German settlers in Palestine. In other words, this designation denoted the linked ethno-national and territorial components of the new Jewish identity. The products boycotted by the campaigners therefore fell into two categories, imports into Palestine and local non-Jewish products. These two categories differed in the level of political threat opposed to Zionist economic separatism and did not receive the same treatment. The campaigners' fight against imported products was explicit because Palestine's trade imbalance often concerned the British and the Arabs as well. The campaigns against local non-Jewish products were more important to establish a separatist Zionist identity in relation to the Arab world. But the explicit ethno-national separatism was not politically expedient because it negated the British official stand. Hence, when some organizations promoting separatist consumption translated their names to English, they used territorial rather than ethnic wording, such as Council for Home Products, the Pro-Palestine Products Committee, and so on. For example, the Palestine Association of Citron Growers campaigned in 1933 against competing Arab products and was rebuked by Chaim Arlozorov, the secretary of the political department of Jewish Agency, who warned activists not to be so blunt in their advocacy of ethno-national separatism and consumption. Indeed, a British firm investigating the idea of establishing a factory in Palestine expressed surprise in discovering that, quote, "when the Jews advocate for local products, they do not mean the country's products, but Jewish products," end of quote. But for most people involved, this wasn't much of a surprise. The tension between ethno-national and the territorial components of the campaigns may be further illustrated by examining the differences between Jews and Arabs in dealing with a bilateral trade treaty with French-mandated Syria, which inundated Palestine with inexpensive agricultural and light industrial products and was the biggest threat on local production at the time. Nahum Tishbi, who was the head of the Department for Commerce and Industry in the Zionist Executive and a prominent advocate for separatist consumption, asked a Syrian biscuit manufacturer what he would do if the British abrogated this treaty and levied taxes on Syrian imports. To Tishbi's disappointment, the manufacturer replied that he would relocate his factory from Beirut to Acre and continue selling to Tel Aviv. From the perspective of many Zionists, the economic struggles against Arab-Palestinian products and Syrian imports were one and the same. Had they wanted to conduct an effective struggle against the Syrian treaty, they would have more fully cooperated with Arab Palestinian manufacturers and merchants to promote the potential civic Palestinian identity. Yet the latter was not, although the latter was not popular in Palestine, during most interwar era, it was not yet off the table, as Jews and Arabs occasionally worked together toward a shared territorial interest and campaigned for more stringent protection of the autarkic, or supposed to be autarkic, Palestinian economy. In the footwear industry, for example, Palestinian Jewish and Arab manufacturers banded together against the flooding of the local market with cheap Syrian and European shoes. In 1930, a Czech shoe company opened 4 branches in Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, Nazareth, and Tiberias. It offered inexpensive products along with innovative marketing and advertising techniques, such as commercial during movie screenings in theaters. In response, more than 700 Jewish and Arab shoemakers gathered in Jerusalem, an Armenian was elected chair, if you wondered, and demanded government implement a protectionist policy favoring Palestinian domestic production. According to a senior Zionist official, this meeting was quietly organized by no other than the aforementioned Nahum Tishbi. In Tel Aviv, too, hundreds of shoemakers assembled to discuss similar concerns, though all of members of this group were Jewish and were more concerned with Jewish than domestic Palestinian production. Hence, they did not come up with any effective policy proposal, but only, quote, expressed their confidence in the quality of their products, end quote. 2 months later, someone pasted placards in Tel Aviv that printed the names of habitants who dared to buy foreign shoes, revealing that confidence to be unwarranted, again, similar to what happened in Poznan. In the 1920s, the campaigns generally failed to change the shopping habits of the consumers. Ethno-national separatism in consumption gained effective momentum only in the mid-1930s, as the political and economic competition between the two ethno-national sectors escalated. While the issue of the Jewish society witnessed rising economic prosperity due to the influx of new immigrants and capital from Europe, many Palestinian Falachin peasants lost their land and were proletarianized. In April 1936, this led to the outbreak of the most violent conflict in Mandatory Palestine, commonly referred to as the Arab Revolt, which lasted until 1939 and in which several thousand Arabs and hundreds of Jews and British officers were killed. The deepening economic conflict between the two ethno-national sectors was apparent among other economic realms such as land and labor in the field of consumption. In 1935, after 15 years of grassroots activity, which was not very effective, the diverse local organizations came together under an umbrella organization, the Merkaz Leman Tozerta, the Center for the Land's Products, which was financially sponsored by the Jewish National Committee in Palestine and several Jewish businesses. Although this coordination was catalyzed by the 1936 violent conflict, it had actually started earlier. The separatist campaigns expanded further during the violence of 1936 to 39, which interrupted manufacturers' access to markets and fueled mutual and now more effective calls for boycotts of Jewish and Arab products from both sides. For example, from April to June 1936, Jewish vegetables were sold in Tel Aviv in much higher quantities than in the same quarter of the previous year. The ethnic components of the campaigns was now amplified. The violent conflict also rendered the campaign's condemnation of disloyal merchants and consumers more effective. And there are also a few violent incidents between activists of the campaigns and deviating merchants. Inter-ethnic trade in Palestine was considerably reduced. For the first time, the campaign for Jewish consumption seemed to work, at least to a degree. I would like now to say a few words about the goals and methods of this activity. Although buying Jewish was depicted as the common good of Jewish workers, capitalists, farmers, and the urban middle class, in fact, these goals were quite diverse due to the significant internal differences within the Jewish community in Palestine. In order to promote the purchase of Jewish products, campaigners had to first to identify such products in the market by making white lists of legitimate businesses and products that were labeled with the trademark of Tutzeret Haaretz, that is, local and Jewish. Drawing up those lists involved major political decisions regarding the conceptual problem of how a Jewish product should be defined, uncovering the socio-political diversity behind the apparent unity of the issue. First of all, there was the burning political dispute over the question, what constituted the Jewishness of a product, Jewish capital or Jewish labor? While the criterion of Jewish labor crossed out Jewish businesses that employed non-Jews from the list, the criterion of Jewish capital crossed out businesses with non-Jewish partners. And if it was the work, as it was believed in most contemporaneous economic nationalist philosophies, does the business have to be organized with one of the larger Jewish organizations affiliated with the Jewish Workers' Federation, the Histadrut? In a few cases, the trademark of a Jewish product was even given to importers who sponsored the campaigns, and in others, to Arab merchants who were known to be political allies of the Zionists. Ideological considerations aside, the most difficult complication is in determining the Jewishness of product was linked to the extension of commodity chains, which made identifying a product's origins almost impossible. Due to the rapid industrialization of Palestine's economy during the Mandate period, production and distribution processes involved increasing numbers of stages, not only in financial services such as banking and insurance, but also in agriculture and manufacturing. Hence, it was more and more difficult to make clear distinctions between the various sources of raw materials, packing materials, credit services, and transportation. And Frank mentioned such a conflict yesterday about Swedish and Polish conflict. Hence, it was more and more difficult to make clear distinctions between the various sources of raw materials. I've read that. For example, so-called Jewish bread was baked in Jewish bakeries. But where did the flour come from? In some cases, it did come from a Jewish mill, but one such Haifa mill did not use the Jewish shipping company to import its grain. And what about Jewish oranges picked by Jewish workers but packed in imported boxes? A subcommittee of the Merkaz of the center deliberated upon these quasi-Talmudic issues and came to incoherent conclusions. Hardly any product could be found that was handled solely by Jews throughout the entire chain of production and distribution. Ironically, but accordingly, once products were tagged, they were spoken of as Jewish or foreign, as if those were their essential qualities, and like most gray areas, the discourse about purity and danger intensified in the public sphere. Words such as defilement or purification were used quite literally in discussions of money, labor, or products in the market or at home. Now, during the Mandate period, the political logic of ethnic nationalism fostered economic separatism. As Jews and Arabs increasingly organized their economic lives as capitalists, workers, and consumers within their own national communities. As we have seen, there was some overlap, but a process of separation is apparent in historical perspective. Zionism employed the discourse of economic nationalism supported by the voluntary moral power of ideology rather than sovereign power, which it didn't have, and sought to define the economy on an ethno-national rather than an inter-ethnic territorial basis. Although many individual Jewish consumers ignore the moral pressure in favor of their families' needs over national interests, the language of a separate Jewish economy and Arab economy, rather than a shared Palestinian economy, was gradually created during the Mandate period, supported by the deepening structural economic divergences between the two communities. Gradually, more and more Jews demonstrated the priority of ethnic identification over other possible identification, including class, gender, age, I mean youth or adults, or a binational form of territorial citizenship. In purchasing a product identified as Jewish, customers fulfilled, intentionally or unwittingly, the ideological directive of supporting the national struggle. All Jewish consumers thus participated in building the national economy, albeit with varying degrees of personal involvement. The consumer emerged as an informal citizen of the Jewish economic nation. As we have seen, the ethnic origins of products could be defined only as long as the details of the production process were not examined too closely. The campaigns indeed failed to clearly define a Jewish product. Yet, These are precisely the contradictions and tensions that foster the emergence of the consumer as a citizen and the sphere of consumption as an arena for identity struggles in interwar Palestine. The movement for separatist consumption revealed their particularly ethnic exclusive nature of Jewish nationalism, not only in the eyes of the yeshuv's leadership or organized workers, but also in those of the Jewish middle class, which increasingly perceived Mandate Palestine as a dual society divided along ethno-national lines. Now, what can we infer from this particular case on the historical dynamics of boycotts in general? To conclude, I would like to suggest three possible implications. First, as a political tool, the boycotts might not always prove effective to achieve the explicit economic political goal overstated by the campaigners, in our case, changing the shopping habits of the citizens to buy Jewish. However, it might quite effectively carry out the socio-political tasks of consolidating the community, defining its borders towards the open market and protecting them in public discourse. In other words, the boycott's most powerful, if hidden, effect is on internal politics rather than external. Second, even as an internal political tool, the boycott may turn out to be a boomerang, if you like, a two-edged sword. In order to protect the community's borders, one has first to locate and define them, which may involve major political decisions in disputed issues. In some cases, it might create new rifts in society or highlighting existing ones rather than consolidating the community. And the third implication is more is for us scholars. As we have seen, the organized boycott may sometimes follow the historical course of events rather than altering it. And this is again a recurring theme in this conference. The boycott is therefore our most efficient methodological tool for historians and social scientists interested in the actual recruitment capacity of social and political movements. The boycott may well use as a good seismograph with which scholars may weigh up the true grip of such movement in civil society, not only in the public sphere, but also in the private one and everyday life. Thank you very much.